Okay, on Sunday, the big Greek vote, whether to accept conditions from its creditors or whether to reject them, as Prime Minister Tsipras and Yiannis Varoufakis are urging. It's the day after the first Greek loan default, where €1.5 billion was supposed to be paid back, and that's, what, 2.1 million Aussie good ones, 2.1 billion Aussie good ones, dear listener. Funny money, but not a funny situation, as Oliver will attest. Oliver, as I said, upset with all of them, Germany, France, the IMF and Greece. And Oliver, thanks for staying up. It's pretty late over there.
It's just after midnight. It's great to be back with you, Philip.
Things are not rotten in the state of Denmark, but further south you think that they're really on the nose. So let me sit back while you explain your thesis.
My basic thesis is that there are no innocent parties in this European debt crisis, that basically everybody has to take some bit of the blame for what we're currently seeing around Athens and Brussels, really, and that the crisis that we're talking about didn't just start a week ago. It didn't start when the current Greek government took office. It didn't even start in 2010. I think it started way earlier, back in the 1990s when the Eurozone started. And ever since, I think we have seen policies in all European capitals that have gone in exactly the wrong direction.
You rather charmingly describe the situation as a combination of chutzpah, aggression, and political dilettantism by all players.
Yes, and I think the basic mistake was to start with European Monetary Union when the continent simply wasn't ready for it. I remember that very well because I was in Germany at the time, I was studying economics, and my professors at university already said that this simply couldn't work. They started petitions against European Monetary Union because they argued it was simply coming too early. They were not completely against European Union or European integration, but they simply argued that you cannot introduce a monetary union for a continent when the countries are not ready for it. There is a theory, of course, in economics that's called the optimum currency theory, and that basically explains what conditions have to be met in order to introduce the currency for different countries. And really looking across Europe at the time, it should have been blatantly obvious that the continent wasn't just ready for it. They did it anyway, and I think the reasons why they introduced monetary union for Europe were simply political. They had nothing to do with economics. And one of the reasons, and I'm writing about this today in my column in the Business Spectator, of course, that it was a French insurance policy against German power. There is no coincidence that both German unification and the decision to introduce European monetary union both happened in the early 90s because they were intricately linked. The French at the time were very, very concerned that a unified Germany would be a much more powerful neighbor to the east, and they were afraid of that. And in the negotiations that led towards Germany's unification, it is now...
So you're telling me that it wasn't for a united Europe, but for a somewhat weakened Germany?
That is at least what the French tried to achieve. The French were really afraid that this new Germany, 82 million people in the middle of Europe, their big neighbor to the east, would just be the ugly Germany that the French had, of course, come to know in the course of the 20th century. So they forced the Germans, basically as a condition of German unification, to give up the mark and introduce the euro. And that's quite well documented these days. And there has been a lot of pressure, really, from the French towards introduction of a euro currency.
But, Oliver, why did the Germans give up the all-powerful Deutschmark?
Well, they simply didn't want to give it up. If you had asked the Germans, if you had held a referendum at the time, I think about 70% of the Germans would have said no. But there was, of course, a reason why Chancellor Helmut Kohl at the time never put it to a referendum. Actually, he said in a few years ago that he knew precisely that this was never going to survive a referendum in Germany, which is exactly why he'd never put it to a referendum. He just decided to go ahead regardless because he knew that that was exactly what he had to do to calm French fears of an overpowerful Germany. And so basically what happened was, for political reasons, European Monetary Union was introduced, the Germans had to give up the Deutschmark, and the French believed that that was actually weakening the Germans, when in fact, as we can see today, it's probably actually increased German power, because now Germany is the most powerful player in this euro crisis, probably, I would argue, against the Germans' will.
Okay, I'll go back to Greece in due course, but let us focus on the point you made that German economists weren't going to take this lying down. You talk about innumerable qualified ones trying to oppose this this thing. Why did it prevail? Why did the idea of union prevail when there were so many doubters?
Precisely because it wasn't an economic question. European Monetary Union has never been an economic question. It has always been a political question. If you had asked economists, European Monetary Union simply wouldn't have happened. If you had asked economists, it would have been designed differently. And if you had asked economists, I think we wouldn't have seen the kind of bailout policies we've seen over the past 5 years. European Monetary Union, from the day it was started, was a political project. And you could see this quite clearly early on, when it was decided who was going to be the first president of the European Central Bank, for example. Now, that, according to the treaties, was a position that was to be filled for 8 years to make the European Central Bank independent and really remove it from political influence. Did that happen? Well, of course not. The first president of the European Central Bank was forced to resign before he had even taken office, because that was a compromise that had to be found because there were two candidates for the position. And so even before the European Central Bank even started operations, there was already political meddling involved. So it was always a political project, and economic considerations always played second fiddle.
We've established that the Deutschmark was an optimum currency. What about the franc at the time?
Well, for the French, as for many other European nations, it was just a nuisance, because over the course of post-war history, they had to devalue their currencies against the Deutschmark time and again. And that was, of course, an embarrassment. It was unpopular in those countries, which was just another reason why they pushed the Germans towards giving up the Deutschmark. And just looking at the history of European currencies before the introduction of the euro, you can see that practically all of these currencies lost a substantial amount of their value against the Deutschmark. So the Deutschmark remained strong. Other European currencies devalued. Actually, the currency that devalued most against the Deutschmark in the 35 years before the euro was introduced was the Greek drachma. It lost about 98% of its value against the mark.
And it makes the British attitude to keep Europe at a distance and to maintain sterling sound a bit more rational.
Well, there are very few things, I think, that the British can be thankful for towards Gordon Brown. One of the things that they can thank him for is actually to give independence to the Bank of England. The other one is actually to keep Britain out of the Eurozone. I think Tony Blair at the time would have been much more favourable towards a British entry into the Eurozone, and Gordon Brown was vehemently against it, and I think in hindsight he's vindicated.
Of course, the wider world looked upon this great adventure in Europe with considerable warmth and approval. They too had lingering memories of World War II. They liked the idea of a divided Europe, kissing, making up, and blending and melding. The idea of moving from country to country without passport restrictions. This was a very thrilling era.
Yes, and I grew up in Europe, and I like traveling from country to country without passport. I think that's wonderful. Actually, what I would say is that this European project, European integration, the European common market, it should have been declared complete in 1992. That was when the European common market was established and completed, and that's when you had the so-called four freedoms. That's when you could have free movement of people, of capital, of goods, of services around Europe, across borders, but really without borders. I think that's the maximum that Europe could have reasonably achieved. Taking it that one step further, introducing a European currency, simply was that step that was too far. And actually doing so destroyed everything else that has been built before. Remember, in the 1990s, European countries were not talking badly about each other. We didn't have the kind of acrimony that you now see between Greece and Germany. That was actually a Europe that was becoming much more united, and I think it was a great time for Europe. Introducing European Monetary Union, I think, actually destroyed what was really good about the European Union.
Let's go back to the doleful drachma. You're absolutely emphatic that Greece didn't measure up on that, on the question of its currency. So was Greece thrilled to be in?
I think they were initially, because there were, of course, some positives about joining the European Monetary Union for Greece. not least, interest rates were suddenly coming down. Greece, of course, like many other Mediterranean countries, traditionally had very high interest rates. The moment it entered monetary union, these interest rates fell, and that therefore the Greeks could actually consume more. So it was a very pleasant time for a lot of Greeks. It was also a pleasant time, of course, for Greek governments at the time, because suddenly borrowing costs came down. What happened was basically convergence between the borrowing costs that the Greek government had to pay and the interest rates that the German government had to pay. Now, markets basically didn't differentiate anymore between the Greek and the German government because they assumed that as part of the Eurozone, there was practically nothing separating them. And so it was a very pleasant situation for Greek consumers. It was a very pleasant situation for the Greek government. But of course, it came at the cost of some long-term problems. And the long-term problems that I see for Greece were, before the euro was introduced, as I mentioned, the Greek drachma continually devalued. And that was one of the ways in which Greece could actually stay competitive with the rest of Europe. Once you actually locked Greece into the eurozone, they had no longer control of their own currency. And that meant they could no longer have this kind of external devaluation that Greece for a long, long time had been practicing.
Now, you've already made the point that Tsipras and Varoufakis didn't create the crisis. They've inherited it. What advice would you have been giving them in the last month or so?
Exactly the same advice that I have been trying to give the previous governments via my column for the past 5 years. I think there is really only one way for Greece out of the crisis. I think the focus that we currently have on just government debt is too narrow. What we're talking about is a symptom of the crisis. The real cause of the crisis is precisely that Greece no longer could devalue its currency after entry into the eurozone, and it had become uncompetitive, basically. It had become too expensive. So unit labor costs in Greece are, by some estimates, between 30 and 40% too high compared to its neighbors. So I think, and that's my advice to the government, the only chance that Greece really has to recover is outside the eurozone. They have to take Greece out of the eurozone. They might re-enter at a future stage when Greece is ready, although I think that's a long time away. But if Greece really wants to be competitive with its neighbors, say with Turkey or with Bulgaria, they need to become cheaper. They can't become cheaper as part of the eurozone because they have no control of the currency. They have to do it outside, and I think that's the only chance they have. And once they've done that, I think they, of course, have to reform the economy. They, of course, have to reform the tax system. They have to do a lot of things, and I think they also deserve a cut of their borrowings and their debt because it's simply not sustainable. So they need to have that haircut that Yanis Varoufakis and Alexis Tsipras want to see. I completely agree with them, but I think they only have a chance if they also take the country out of the eurozone.
Oliver, I thank you very much, and thanks for staying up. Dr. Oliver Hartwich, Executive Director of the New Zealand Initiative, and a columnist in Business Spectator. And we now go from one economic crisis, a particularly large one, to, as I promised you earlier, an analysis of the ongoing looting of Africa, when my guest is Tom Burgess.